This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to GEICO.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
Compass Media Networks. This is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Managing antidepressants. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
Researchers are doing brain studies to see who's most likely to suffer a relapse of depression. It's designed to help doctors decide who needs the medication long term.
The NCAA basketball tournament, or March Madness, will be whittled down to the Sweet 16 by Sunday night. Who gets credit for those phrases?
In politics, the words used most often by certain presidential candidates.
And how the government cracks smartphones without help from the likes of Apple.
Is that the government actually does a pretty good job of getting into a lot of smartphones without any help from Apple or other phone makers such as Android. They use some hacker tools that are out there. So even though you hear the government saying, we can't get into this phone and Apple won't help us, the fact is in a lot of other cases, they can get into that phone with no problem at all.
Yahoo columnist Rick Newman on the hacker tools used by the government. He's here in about 25 minutes. Well, it is one of the most common and wrenching decisions in mental health, when to stop taking antidepressant medication. Wall Street Journal reporter Andrea Peterson has a deep dive on this critical healthcare decision, which is often made by patients on their own. Andrea, set this up.
It's really one of the most common decisions, and it can be really pretty tortured in mental health, is when to stop antidepressant medication once you're in remission from anxiety or depression. And the thing is, there's really no great long-term data on when to stop. The thing is, though, that long-term maintenance treatment with antidepressants can prevent relapse, and that's sort of the biggest risk of going off antidepressant medication is that you can relapse, and the risk of relapse is pretty high. About, if you've had one episode of depression, you have about a 50% chance of having a second one, and if you've had two episodes, you have an 80% chance of having another.
Wow.
And continuing on antidepressant medication can cut the risk of relapse in half.
Okay, but the downside is there are side effects.
Right. I mean, a lot of people don't like taking these medications. I mean, there are some significant side effects, and especially if you're feeling well, you know, things like weight gain, sexual dysfunction. Some patients complain of flattened emotions, and especially for people who are diagnosed, you know, since a lot of people are diagnosed with depression or anxiety disorders in their 20s and 30s, you know, the prospect of staying on these medications for decades is, you know, pretty unappealing to a lot of people.
All right. So as you point out in the story too, part of the problem is that patients decide on their own when to stop taking these antidepressants.
Right. I mean, one study that followed people that had had recurrent episodes of depression found that more than 40% of them did not take the drugs as their doctors prescribed. And I had one psychiatrist tell me that she actually brings up the topic of how and when to stop antidepressants before she even puts patients on them, because so many patients just start going off them without telling their doctors because they're afraid the doctors will say no. And if you stop antidepressants abruptly, that can cause withdrawal symptoms that can be pretty troublesome on their own. You can have flu-like symptoms, you can have dizziness, so it's really better to taper them slowly under a doctor's supervision if you are going to go off them. And one interesting thing is, now scientists are starting to, the trouble is that, you know, if you have, you know, one episode of depression, you have a 50% chance of having another one, but you have a 50% chance of not having another one. So what doctors are trying to find out is, you know, are there tests? Are there signature brain activity? What are called biomarkers that can help doctors make that decision?
That is something. Where are they going to go with kind of this newer information? Are they trying to develop necessarily better drugs, or just some of those examining signs of those biomarkers?
Well, I mean, the biomarker research is kind of in two areas. One is actually, there's a lot of really exciting work trying to identify, first of all, which patients will respond better to medication or to therapy. So it would be sort of a test that you would do to sort of before you even start on a treatment before, because the problem is as you probably know, you know, a lot of people don't respond to antidepressant medication right off the bat. And it can often take several different trials of different medications to find one that works.
Yeah.
You know, some people respond much better to a course of cognitive behavioral therapy. So there's that, and then there's also this biomarker research that's looking into helping to identify those patients that are at a much higher risk of relapse. I mean, there's first of all, there's even, you know, what doctors do know now is that, you know, obviously once you've had, the more episodes of depression you have, the more likely you are to relapse. So that is one thing. Also, if you have residual symptoms, so you're in remission, you're feeling pretty good, but say you have some sleep disturbances still, or you have some difficulties concentrating, those residual symptoms do indicate that you are more likely to relapse. So that's another thing that psychiatrists really, really look for when they're helping patients make that decision of whether to come off of it. Also, you know, one psychiatrist said he always makes sure to ascertain what kind of stressors people have going on in their lives. You know, say if you're going through a divorce, if, you know, you're changing jobs, I mean, that really might not be the time to go off your antidepressants, because those kind of stressors can also increase the risk of relapse.
Thanks, Andrea. Wall Street Journal reporter Andrea Peterson, who's based in New York. 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. The new high-performance Dell Latitude systems are the most secure, manageable, and reliable business-class laptops and two-in-ones, so employees can do their best work. Outfitted with the latest Intel Core processors, your team can reduce downtime by 50% and boost productivity with 4 times the performance. Make your work beautiful again at Dell.com/radio. Again, Dell.com/radio. Thanks for being here. Which presidential candidate is best for your wallet? Lauren Lyons Cole at International Business Times looks at the tax plans from Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Hillary Clinton to see which one is best for your personal finances. Lauren, what do we have here?
A lot of times we're listening to all the proposals from the candidates, and we're not really thinking how it's going to come out of our paycheck. But at the end of the day, if whoever does get elected could very well impact our paycheck. Of course, it depends on Congress actually approving any sort of tax changes they might want to make. But it really is, it goes beyond just the 1%. Even people earning normal amounts of money can see their paycheck changed.
All right. So a lot of talk, obviously, about the middle class in this particular election cycle. What are there any specifics out there that people could really hang their hat on and say, I want this candidate because of X economic policy?
Well, if you're just thinking about your personal finances and nothing else, Donald Trump's tax plan is actually the most friendly to the average American taxpayer. Of course, the wealthiest will get the biggest benefit, but even someone making $30,000 a year would see an increase in their paycheck. For example, a family making $75,000 a year would see as much as $3,000 extra dollars over the course of the year in their paycheck, which is not a small amount of money,
yeah,
especially when most people are living paycheck to paycheck.
But at what cost, right? Didn't one of these analytical groups say he was going to add like upwards of $10 trillion to the national debt, right? I mean, that's got to come,
yeah,
from somewhere, I guess.
Right. I mean, I've even heard estimates that are higher than $10 trillion. $10 trillion is kind of the lower estimate. So yeah, it comes at a great cost. Obviously, the money has to come from somewhere. So either we're paying the taxes for programs, or we're cutting the programs. But even with a $10 trillion deficit, that's the largest that's ever been proposed. So it would, first of all, it'd be tough for Congress to approve any of this. But second of all, it would be a big problem. And just to put it in context, the federal deficit for 2016 is just around $500 billion.
Mm.
So we'd be looking at $10 trillion over the next decade, which is a pretty big jump from where we're at today, which is still a pretty big deficit.
All right. So talk about some of the other impacts on paychecks, I guess, either from Trump's plan or somebody else.
Well, so with Hillary Clinton's plan, hers is the most similar to what we have now. You probably won't even notice if she goes into office, your paycheck, unless you make more than $1 million a year, more than $5 million a year, if her tax policies went into place for those Americans, they would actually see quite a big tax increase. But for most of us, it wouldn't be a difference.
All right. So it's hard to do anything massively impactful, I guess, right? One, it's got to get through Congress. Two, I don't know, there doesn't seem to be a lot of wiggle room in the budget at times.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing is that these would have to get through Congress, but you still want to choose the candidate who aligns with your personal values and taking into consideration the amount of money that you're going to pay for those priorities. Mm. So it's getting your money's worth to a certain extent.
All right, so break down a little bit more of Mrs. Clinton's plan, the tax brackets and who might get what.
Her tax brackets are pretty similar. So Donald Trump simplifies it. A lot of the Republican candidates want to simplify the tax code, which at 70,000 pages and counting, it's a complicated piece of policy. But Donald Trump wants to break it down to just four different tax brackets. Hillary Clinton keeps it pretty much the same as what we have now, but she does add an extra 4% surcharge, a surtax on the highest earners. So for people earning over $5 million, they will see an extra tax bracket essentially for those people.
Got it. We're speaking with Lauren Lyons Cole, personal finance editor at International Business Times. Her piece is called How the Race for President Could Affect Your Paycheck, looking at the economic proposals of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Are these candidates, by the way, who say, hey, read my economic proposal, it's on blahblahblah.com, and nobody reads that stuff, right? Well, except you.
Well, yeah, I actually really enjoyed reading through them, but it's not something that a lot of people really want to spend the time doing, but Americans do care a lot about the economy in this election cycle. Republicans tend to say they care more about the deficit, but Democrats tend to say they care more about wage inequality and employment, but it really is top of mind for a lot of people. So I think going into the voting booth in November, people are going to have these, they're going to need to understand what these policies mean for their wallet and what they mean for the country.
There's nothing wildly new, right? There's no candidate out there with something completely unique.
Actually, it's funny that you say that. Ted Cruz has a completely creative and unique approach to the tax code, and I think it would be very difficult to get that approved because it is essentially throwing out what we have and starting over from scratch.
Is that the flat tax you're talking about?
The flat tax, it's relatively complicated because he essentially switches the tax burden from the individual to the corporations, and we would end up paying about the same amount of taxes. It's just the way that we would pay them would be different. So there is the one creative proposal out there.
Thanks, Lauren. Lauren Lyons Cole at International Business Times. 21 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. We've been talking a lot about the Great Courses, and now they're offering something new, the Great Courses Plus video learning service. So instead of just trying to pick one course, you have unlimited access to a huge library of the Great Courses lecture series and so many fascinating subjects. Whatever your interest is, they have one. Maybe it's science, history, or even cooking. You can watch full courses start to finish or just select specific lectures. The Great Courses Plus has nearly 5,000 different video lectures taught by top award-winning professors. You can watch these great video lectures from the Great Courses Plus at any time from anywhere on your TV, laptop, tablet, or smartphone. Just for a limited time, though, the Great Courses Plus is offering this morning listeners a great offer to get you started. Unlimited access to the entire The Great Courses Plus library, completely free for 1 month. All of these fantastic courses available to you free for 1 month. You'll love it. Get started today with this great offer. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/deal. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/deal. Remember the plus. thegreatcoursesplus.com/deal. One of the maddening trends when it comes to identity theft right now is something called ghosting. Cyber crooks are trolling obituaries, piecing together nuggets of information to craft a bogus identity in order to scam credit card companies, banks, even surviving relatives. More from Paul Oster, founder and president of Better Qualified, a credit management company based in Eatontown, New Jersey. Paul, how's it work?
It's one of the most sinister crimes I've seen out there. But what happens is, we, like everything else, we make it easy for them. The amount of information that is contained in obituaries that are now, not just in the paper, they're on every social media space out there when someone passes away. And you'll get everything from addresses, dates of births, favorite pets, mother's maiden name. Really, a lot of the pieces of the puzzle needed to assume or steal someone's identity is right there in black and white. So the hospitals, the funeral homes, these obituaries, this is really where that information is being obtained from.
Wow. But that information's been in newspaper obituaries forever. Has it always been that type of problem, or is it just different with, electronic media today?
I think electronic media just exposes that many more people to it. A lot of the obituaries are town-specific, they're localized. Contrary to social media pages, Facebook being probably the biggest one where, you know, that's just seen by so many people, you know, in public forums. So it's been around for a while. I think what the identity thieves have figured out, which is crazy to me, that these government agencies are not cross-checking with one another. We did a piece not too long ago about childhood identity theft, and everyone says, Paul, how can a 10-year-old open a credit card? It's because the Social Security Administration, the IRS, the credit bureaus themselves, no one is talking to one another about this information.
Wow. We're speaking with Paul Auster, owner and founder of Better Qualified, which is a credit management company in New Jersey. And we're talking about this new trend in identity theft called ghosting. Well, let me ask a basic question. Should we then be changing the way we print or publish obituaries?
100%. You know, you don't need to include all of that information. Again, the people that obituary is important to know that most pertinent information. And you don't need to share, again, the dates of births, the predeceased or surviving people, including their maiden names. Again, we're just making it easy. And one of the things you can do, you know, if it's unfortunate that you lose a spouse or a loved one, you have to be proactive in today's world, and you have to make sure you get a minimum of 12 copies of that death certificate. You have to notify the IRS. You have to notify the Social Security Administration. You can't assume that they're going to be notified.
Wow. And so, all right, when push comes to shove, as long as the IRS has it, are we in decent shape or no? You got to go through that list that you just mentioned.
Yeah, I think you better go through that list. I mean, again, tax fraud is only one piece of the pie. You wouldn't want someone to, you know, be taking someone else's Social Security benefits if there's a surviving spouse.
Yeah.
And again, at the end of the day, most of the times you're not responsible for the debt or any of the financial burden, but it really becomes an inconvenience. And I'm talking about major inconvenience that could take years to, you know, get out of the mess, as opposed to being a little proactive, taking some time if you lose somebody to make sure you mitigate the risk of this happening.
Wow. All right, because obits, they're optional, right? There's nothing legal that says you have to have an obit published somewhere.
That's right. So keep it simple. Keep it, you know, general. Stay away from the specifics again. Dates of birth and maiden names, you know, family members, favorite pets, religious groups, charitable organizations that the person may have been involved with. These are all things that just make it that much easier for people to obtain and or assume their identity.
Wow. All right. So everybody's got a responsibility in this, it sounds like.
It sure does, you know, and again, and what happens is, we all know, it's easier said than done. When you lose somebody, especially if it's your spouse, your father, your parents.
Thanks, Paul. It's Paul Auster. He is the founder and president of Better Qualified Credit Management Company in New Jersey. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. When you're trying to create demand, you need a cost-effective way to reach your target audience and generate qualified leads for your sales team. My recommendation is to use Citrix GoToWebinar. With GoToWebinar, you can present to hundreds with confidence. Whether you're a startup or a company operating worldwide, GoToWebinar can help you connect, captivate, and convert your target audience. It's easy to do. First, pick a compelling topic, select your audience, and schedule your event. With automated emails, custom branding, and practice sessions, GoToWebinar makes getting ready easy. When your event is live, keep attendees engaged with interactive polls, live chat, and respond to feedback in real time. Once your event is over, you're only a click away from reporting on registration attendance and performance metrics of your event. GoToWebinar enables marketers like you to easily reach your target audience and turn leads into customers. Get started with GoToWebinar today to connect and convert. Visit GoToWebinar.com to start your free 30-day trial. That's GoToWebinar.com. Without help from Apple, the FBI says it will remain shut out of an iPhone used by one of the two shooters in last December's mass murder of 14 people in San Bernardino, California. But Yahoo Finance writer Rick Newman says there are still plenty of smartphones the government can crack without court orders, public hearings, or any involvement by phone makers. Rick, what have you uncovered?
Apple, really for the first time starting last October, has said, you know what, we're going to stop helping the government get into these phones, especially the ones with the newer operating systems. So this is setting up a showdown, and we've been doing a lot of reporting on it here at Yahoo Finance. And one of the sort of interesting sidelights when you look at a lot of the court documents is that the government actually does a pretty good job of getting into a lot of smartphones without any help from Apple or other phone makers such as Android. They use some hacker tools that are out there that they just kind of buy off the shelf. They've got other things available to them. So even though you hear the government saying, we can't get into this phone and Apple won't help us, the fact is in a lot of other cases they can get into that phone with no problem at all.
What makes the situation different?
With the new phones, Apple really raised the security features when it introduced the latest operating system for the iPhone, which is called iOS 9. That came out last September. And important to note here, Apple doesn't just install that system on new phones going out the door. They also are very aggressive about pushing updates to people who bought phones before that operating system was developed. And anybody who has an iPhone knows you get these notifications all the time, new operating system available, do you want to upgrade? And all you have to do is basically push yes. So Apple's very aggressive about that, and they've now got this new operating system with these security features that make it really, really hard to crack on about 75% of the iPhones in the United States. That still leaves about 25 million phones that have older operating systems that are easier to crack, and we're not even talking about Android devices here, and there actually are slightly more Android devices in the United States than there are iPhones, and those are apparently a lot easier to get into than an iPhone.
Mm. We're speaking with Yahoo Finance columnist Rick Newman. His piece is called How the Government Cracks into Smartphones Without Any Help from Apple or Google. So you mentioned this device or this technology called the IP Box. How does that work?
This is interesting. This is a tool that somebody in China developed. It's not, as far as we know, sold by the Chinese government. It's just kind of a tech person in China built this device. There are others like it. It's not the only one on the market, but I focused on this particular one, which just apparently became really popular among law enforcement agencies. It went on sale probably around late in 2014. A few companies here in the United States that offer forensic tools to law enforcement agents just began selling this. What they do is they just buy a bunch of them overseas, basically retail, bring them back here, mark them up a little bit, and sell them to law enforcement agencies. I interviewed a guy who runs one of the companies that does this, and he said sales really boomed in 2015. A lot of law enforcement agencies, and you know, it could be the federal government, but also think of local police departments here. They had a lot of iPhones sitting around they couldn't get into, password protected. They didn't know what to do, probably felt like they didn't have the time to go to Apple or didn't want to go to the trouble or didn't want to approach Apple for some other reason. And they saw suddenly this device was available. So they started buying these devices, and apparently law enforcement agencies use this device called the IP Box. And there are a bunch of others like it for both iPhones and Android devices. And that was the way they got a lot of information off of phones during the last, let's say, 18 months or so.
Thanks, Rick. Yahoo Finance writer Rick Newman. 21 minutes before the hour on This Weekend. Sometimes it feels like there aren't enough hours in the day, even when you're working past the 9 to 5. So if you're still making time-consuming trips to the post office, you need a better way. You need to use Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, get the postage you need the instant you need it. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package right from your computer and printer. It's quick and easy. You'll even save money with Stamps.com, too. It's just a fraction of the cost of one of those expensive postage meters. Plus, you'll get special postage discounts you can't even find at the post office. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my last name, Deal, for this special offer. A 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. Get started with Stamps.com today. Within minutes, you'll be printing postage right from your desk. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Deal. That's Stamps.com and enter Deal. Whether you're just starting out, raising a family, or getting ready to retire, developing solid habits for tending your finances means you'll be reaping big awards at some point. But these habits should start as a young adult. There are even some apps that can help. More from This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
When you're in your 20s, wealth may seem like a distant prospect, but the financial habits you establish now can help you build wealth in the years ahead. Here with some tips is Miriam Cross of Kiplinger's. Miriam, we've heard this one before, the importance of making a budget. Why is budgeting so important?
It helps keep your spending in check, so you make sure you have enough money to cover all your essential expenses, such as rent and utilities and your phone, and then also leaves you enough room for the more fun expenses, like going out and trying new restaurants and going on vacation.
What's the easiest way to actually physically make a budget?
The budgeting apps are definitely growing. I know people rave over you need a budget. There's Mint, there's LearnVest, or you can just use Excel. Break your expenses into different categories and set a cap for each one. So if you go over your cap, say you go out to eat a lot and you go over your cap, you're going to have to pull money from a different category, and then you could sort of see the consequences right away of not meeting your budget.
You talk about using a rewards credit card. Why is that important?
So that's another way to do it, is to just put all your discretionary spending on one card. You can then set an alert when you approach your limit. And if you put it all in a rewards card, then you earn some cash back in the process, or points that you could put towards vacations.
Do you think young people understand that?
it's a great way to get free money on spending you're doing anyway.
What about the importance of good credit?
So if you build a credit history when you're young, that'll help you out a lot when you're older, when it's time to get a mortgage or apply for a car loan or even get a job. So you want to start now in making sure everything on your credit reports is clean and that you're paying off your loans on time, that you're using your credit card responsibly, and that'll pay off well into the future.
What's the best way to check your credit score?
To check your credit score, a bunch of banks are offering free credit scores and credit cards, so check with your credit card company to see if they offer that. And then also there's tools at creditkarma.com and Credit Sesame, and they'll monitor your credit reports for you and also give you free score estimates.
Miriam, if you're lucky enough to work for a company that has some kind of a 401k, that's certainly a good way to save. If you have that or don't have that, what are some ways to save?
So if you do have that, you want to definitely put in enough money to get the company match, which may be 4% to 6% of your salary. If you don't have that, then you want to look to other ways, such as a Roth IRA is a great thing to do when you're young, when your salary may not be so high anyway. So even though you don't get a tax break right away, you'll be able to withdraw the money tax-free in retirement.
Is that a scary thing to do if you're worried about paying off student loans?
You want to do both at this. You want to ideally do both at the same time. You want to put money towards your student loans. Make sure you have a manageable repayment plan. If you go to studentloans.gov, they have a repayment estimator, and you can see which plan works best for you. Stretch it out if you need to, but at the same time, you do want to make sure that you're contributing to an emergency fund and that you are putting away money for retirement, because all three of those are very, very important.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Miriam Cross at Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. 14 minutes now before the hour on This Weekend. Have you noticed the particular words or phrases that certain presidential candidates use? If you've watched any of the, 250 or so debates, it seems like, you may have picked up a few. A new analysis shows which words each candidate prefers. Here's MarketWatch reporter Katie Hill. Katie, who says what?
Okay, Donald Trump, number one word, imminent, followed by tremendous and sudden. So the interesting thing about his language is, you probably noticed this, but this was literally like quantifying it. He uses a lot of extreme words. Some of his top words are beautiful, nasty.
Yeah.
Like his language is so much different than any of the other candidates' language because it is so extreme. And often it's just nasty and negative to the point where, I mean, we always think politicians do that, but his is especially like that. He uses words like catastrophe, beautiful, nasty, sudden, tremendous, unbelievable, incompetent. Like, that is the way Donald Trump talks, and it is quite different from how anyone else talks.
Right. You know, he uses those extreme words, but he also uses a lot of superlatives, like this will be the greatest, or the best ever, right? Guaranteed this. A lot of those Yeah, I guess just superlatives would be
it's so noticeable. Like you said, when I think, oh, Ted Cruz, maybe he has similar language, but Ted Cruz, number one word was utterly, and then cronyism, ration. But his words aren't, you know, it's nothing. His list looks nothing like Donald Trump, even though that, you know, they're both Republican contenders. So it's quite interesting to see what they're doing. But whatever Trump's doing, it's obviously working for him.
All right. So who else says what?
Clinton was interesting too. Her number one and two were systemic was number one, children number two, and she was the only candidate that said LGBT. She overused, but that's kind of what it is when they look at these, which words they tend to use way more than other candidates. She used that, but yeah, I thought hers. It was interesting to me. They looked at this, and it just was so different. Also between Republicans and Democrats, it was like we were looking at people talking just in completely different walks of life, completely different issues brought up. And part of that, of course, is the moderators at the debate asking certain questions. But part of it is also just the talking points between these two parties have just separated so much that when you look at the words they use, it looks like night and day between the two.
How about that? Very good. We're speaking with Market Watch reporter Katie Hill. She's got to look at the more popular words and phrases that the presidential candidates use on the campaign trail. Who else is worth a mention?
Bernie Sanders was sort of fun, too. Not fun, but interesting. His number one word was a handful. Quite a handful. You know? He had crumble, speculation, and tuition free. So, again, even though he and Hillary are in the same debate, their words are just not the same thing. It's like they just have their own talking points, and they both just kind of, you know, they go for it. The other thing, which they didn't publish the results, but they told me, which I thought was interesting, is they ran these candidates through a grade level analysis for, you know, what grade level they would be talking at, just looking at all the words. Mm-hmm. And poor Trump, he was the bottom of that barrel for what grade level he was speaking to. Wow. So, yeah, these analyses aren't always that accurate because sometimes length of word counts for grade level, so it's not always the right thing. But they did point that out as well.
Thanks, Katie. MarketWatch reporter Katie Hill, who's based in New York. It is 6 minutes now before the hour on This Weekend. The new high-performance Dell Latitude systems are the most secure, manageable, and reliable business-class laptops and two-in-ones so employees can do their best work. Outfitted with the latest Intel Core processors, your team can reduce downtime by 50% and boost productivity with 4 times the performance. Make your work beautiful again at Dell.com/radio. Again, Dell.com/radio. By the time this weekend is done, we'll be down to the Sweet 16 in the NCAA basketball tournament, also known as March Madness. Ever wonder where these nicknames came from? NPR Digital News says the original March Madness started in 1908 with a boys' high school basketball tournament in Illinois, put together by the Illinois High School Association, or IHSA. Before the NCAA adopted the namesake, a handful of teams from Kentucky high schools called the Sweet 16 drew sold-out crowds to championship games. The number of teams, by the way, participating in IHSA's annual March Madness tournament grew to 900 by the late 1930s. NPR says the High School Association trademarked the term in 1989 and still owns the branding on the high school level. After contentious legal battles, the NCAA acquired a license in 1996 to use March Madness after CBS sportscaster Brent Musburger first uttered the term during the NCAA tournament coverage in the late 1980s. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.
Men, if you're like me, you appreciate the feeling of a clean, smooth shave from a quality blade. The sort of shave that cuts clean, without the burn. So why are you messing around with generic razors that cost $32 for an 8-pack when you can shave with Harry's high-quality German-engineered blades for half the price? And if saving money and a clean shave isn't incentive enough, Harry's will give you their starter set, complete with a razor, 3 of their world-famous blades, and shaving cream for just $15. And shipping is always free. We'll also give you $5 off your first order. Our way of saying thank you for trying us. How are we able to save you all this money and still give you the best shave you'll ever enjoy? By owning the factory that manufactures them. That's how. So go to harrys.com right now and enter code 4000 at checkout. That's harrys.com, code 4000.